departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. Saul's servants then said to him, "Behold, now an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you." And verse 23 says, "So it came about whenever the evil spirit from God came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed and be well." How could an evil spirit come from God, who is perfect and not evil? I want you to think back to the story of Job. And Job was God's servant. And Satan comes up to God and says, "You know, if I were allowed to make things tough for Job, he'd turn around and curse you." But God knew Job very well. And he knew he was faithful. And he said, "You can do anything you want to him, just don't take his life. And we'll test that." God then permitted Satan, an evil spirit, to enter into that circumstance and to work his wrath. And the ultimate result was for God's purpose. When God chose Saul to be king, did he choose Saul because Saul would be a good king? He knew from the beginning that Saul was going to be a failure. But he also knew that Saul looked like, to the people around him, that he was going to be a great leader. And so he's making a point to his people, don't judge your leaders by what they look like. Look, here's a great-looking guy. Let's make him king. Make him king. He's a miserable failure. He disobeys. He assumes responsibilities that he shouldn't have. He doesn't do the things he's supposed to do. And he's horrible. And God says, see, that's what you get. You need to lean on me. Now let me show you this. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to pick someone after my own heart. And I'm going to make him king. And you contrast the difference. Someone that you chose because he looks good, someone that I chose because I understand his heart, and we're going to compare these two kings. And to this day, thousands of years later, we can still do the same thing. Now, we know that today, as a, I guess you would say, a down payment on what shall be, God has given us the gift of his Spirit. And we know that that Spirit is not revoked. That is an eternal gift. It's a down payment on eternity. That is ours. It is solid. It is there. Prior to Jesus saying, "I'm going to send the Comforter," God at will, for according to his purposes, sent his Spirit into different people's lives at different times to cause things to happen according to his plan. And for a time, he put his Spirit into Saul. And Saul began to do things well right off the bat and then began to swerve and resist that spirit and fight it. God knew he was going to do it. God took that spirit away from him. That is something that I mentioned last week. I can't imagine what it would be like to have communion with God on a daily basis, to be able to cry out at any time, "Abba, Father," and know that he's here and know that he listens. That is that indwelling spirit, that comforter, that paraclete that walks along beside us, that is our advocate with the Father. He's there. He encourages us. He guides us in the way that we should go. He gives us words. You know, we're told to be ready to give an accounting for the hope that is within you, and Jake demonstrated that this morning. That hope is in him. All he needed was somebody to say, go, and he was ready. And he was ready because the Spirit is there. But imagine that that Spirit were removed. And all these things that you had relied upon, the knowledge, the comfort that God is there, that God is behind you, especially that God is behind you, and that's gone. And now you realize you're out there all by yourself and you're tasked with being king over his people. And you know that you've been rejected. There is a tremendous void in Saul. He is weak. He is vulnerable. He is unguarded by the Spirit which has been there previously, and he is a victim for the evil spirits which now have an opportunity to come in and torment him. And part of that torment would be, I guess I kind of reminded of the passage about the weeping and the wailing and the gnashing of teeth, when you realize, I could have gone to heaven, but I missed it. Saul begins to realize, I had everything. and I flushed it away. I gave it up. And he's tormented by that and devastated by that. And now you come along David, who the Spirit has been given to, works in a mighty way. And when David is in Saul's presence, there must have been for Saul some sort of an association with that. Ah, yes, I remember. I need that. And so when Saul is being horribly tormented because he has made himself vulnerable, and don't think that you couldn't do the same thing. We're not going to lose the Holy Spirit, but we put ourselves in all kinds of horrible subjective fear when we don't walk closely with that paraclete. When we begin to ignore him, we begin to go our own way. Satan has a chance to start throwing his fiery darts and start to trip us up, try to make us fall, try to make us stumble. So we want to stay close. We don't want to wander like Saul did. We want to stay close like David did. There's also a little bit in the language, and I am no Hebrew scholar whatsoever, but it is my understanding, Hebrew, the Greek is really, really big on prepositions. It'll tell you something was moving towards something, away from something, and it's all kind of spatial. And that's one of the reasons I like Greek, because that's the same kind of mind that I have. Three-dimensional, I put things in charts, and I move things around, and that's how I do it. Hebrew is very, very different. Hebrew is more like Chinese, where they have all these different characters, and each character is a whole story or a whole idea or a whole concept, and it brings emotion and all these other things into there. So when they translate that into English and they put that an evil spirit from God, I believe what that idea of from is that it is apart from God. An evil spirit apart from God, separated, then comes in. So here's Saul, had everything that any man could ever need, had the blessing of God himself, had his spirit given to him, and he ignored it and walked away. And God said, I've rejected you. I'd actually rejected you from the beginning. I was just going to make a point, and I'm going to bring out David. And so now we come to the point where God, in his benevolence toward David, has led him to be in a position where he's in Saul's court. He's learning from Saul. He's learning how things go around because he is one day to be king. Now, David's inclination, what happened right after he was anointed as king? He went back to his sheep. That's weird to me. If somebody came to me and said, okay, you're going to be the next president of the United States, I'm going to go out and start being presidential. I'm going to start assuming that role. David was not that way at all. He was unassuming. He was humble. We'll get in at the end of this talk. We'll kind of get into some of the characters of David that we've revealed from these passages. So, verse 21 of chapter 16, David comes to Saul, attends him. Saul loved him greatly, becomes his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, and he said, I want David to stand before me. He's found favor in my sight. I don't want him to take care of your sheep anymore. I want him to be my personal. You remember the warnings about what a king would do? He'll take your sons? That's precisely what's happening here. And poor Jesse, he's lost his son and his shepherd, and now David's gone off to serve Saul and take care of his needs and wants. David would take the harp and he'd play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed and be well, and the evil spirit would depart from him. One of the reasons the evil spirit would depart, because they don't like to be around the Holy Spirit. Those evil spirits don't come into this building. They don't have a chance. Chapter 17. The Philistines gathered their armies for battle. They were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Socoh and Azekah. This is about 12 to 15 miles west of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's up in the high country, and you kind of work your way down this wadi and into the valley of, is it Elah? Is that what it is? Yeah, the valley of Elah. And if you Google that, after you get through all of this garbage about some movie that was called the Valley of Elah, you can actually find pictures and Google Maps and whatnot and see the actual scene where the battle took place. And what you have is a big, broad, wide valley, unlike what we typically see in Wyoming. And a hill on one side, a hill on another side, and one of them has a big bluff behind it. And you can picture thousands of men on either side on these hills, and kind of a sloping open plain, and then a dry creek bed down in the middle. And that's physically the scene. as we come here. Saul, this is chapter 17, verse 2. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah. They drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. They put on all their armor. They grabbed their swords. They went out and stood up to fight the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, and the valleys between them. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now you notice that it doesn't say he was a giant. It says a champion came out from the Philistines. And if you look carefully and you look in parallel passages, and I'm not going to draw them all up here, there is some discrepancy here. Now we believe in its original autographs that the Bible was letter perfect. The way that God delivered it to men and the way they first wrote it down was absolutely perfect and without flaw. But you cannot get around the fact that here it says one thing, and in another book it says another thing. In one place, here, you know, we read the story of David killing Goliath. Well, in 2 Samuel, it says somebody else killed Goliath. How can that be? If you look carefully at the text, you can begin to understand how somebody at some point misunderstood something, and how it should read is the brother of Goliath. I can't remember his name right now, but he killed the brother of Goliath. And it's a long, convoluted thing. I don't want to get into all of that now. But I will tell you that if you're not prepared to understand that there are some minor discrepancies in what we read today, it'll trip you up. Because we've always been taught God's word is perfect. And yes, God's word is perfect. What we have here is, frankly, a slightly imperfect copy of it. And I know that's a scary thing. So in this particular verse, it says that Goliath was 6 cubits and a span. The cubit's about 18 inches. So if you do the math, that means he's about 9'6". That's a big man. And a lot of people would scoff at that, except until 1940, when he died, there was one man living in America who was 8'11". There are lots of pictures of him on the internet. He's really amazing. He's standing in these buildings, and all of the other men are around him, are, you know, 5-6 feet tall. I want to, if Scotty will bear with me, Jim, would you stand up? Would you come stand right here for a minute? Scotty, would you come stand by Jim? Just come stand by Jim for a minute. Imagine, if you would, that this is a normal man in the time of Saul and David, and he would stand about 5'2". Now, Saul stood head and shoulders above the rest, so he would probably be somebody about this tall. And Goliath, bigger than Jim. Do you think it's an even match? Do you think if you guys were going to have a fight, who'd win? You can go sit down. Thank you. Interestingly enough, if you go to this, the text that what we read today, the Masoretic text on which this version is based, goes back as far as the 10th century. And that's about as far back as we have traced the lineage of the Pendergraph family, just to give you an idea. You know, so it really isn't that far back. 10th century, so about the time the Normans invaded Ireland, was the oldest record that we have of what this is made from, the Masoretic text. We have some much older texts, and they come in a couple of forms. One of them is the Septuagint, which was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was done years before Christ, and we have some dating clear back to the first century, some copies of that. And in the Septuagint, this passage says that Goliath was 4 cubits and a span, which would make him 6'9". Well, that's interesting, because here we have a much older account that says something slightly different. And then in addition to that, when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls and they're looking through all these ancient 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century manuscripts, in there, Goliath is listed as 4 cubits and a span. It's possible that at some point during the history of the Masoretic text, somebody exaggerated, somebody misread something, wrote something down. We don't know. The fact is, we don't know how tall Goliath was. He might have been 6'9", he might have been 9'9". But the point is, he's a big man. If the average man is 5'2", maybe, he's a big man. And I brought up the idea from the very beginning that it never says in this verse that he's a giant. It just says he was a champion. It was common in those days, rather than have one army go out and slaughter another army and cause all kinds of devastation, they would just match their champions, and then whoever won from there, their army would win, and that nation would be in subjection. The other subjection, they'd pay their taxes and go on at life. Actually, it was a pretty good deal in that you're not just all going to be mercilessly slaughtered. So that's kind of the scene. Verse 5 of 1 Samuel chapter 17, he had a bronze helmet on his head. He was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. That's about 180 pounds. Now, some of us have served in the military, and we've carried rucksacks and whatnot, and you get 30, 40, 50 pounds, that's a lot. Some of these guys today are carrying equipment around that runs 70, 80 pounds. That's a lot of weight. 180 pounds. He's a big man, and he's strong. He's tough. Every man that looks at him looks at him and then starts thinking about themselves. How am I going to go up against that? I don't see it happen. Not only that, but he also had this guy that runs in front of him that is the shield bearer. The shield bearer was there because the enemy often had archers. And so he walks out there with his little sword on, or he's got his sword in his arm and he's got his shield on his, a little shield on his arm, and he goes out there cutting and slashing and whatnot. And if the enemy archers on the other hill wanted to send over a wave, he could step up and duck behind that tall shield that the shield bearer was wearing. And so it was kind of like a phalanx, you know, they just move along together. Incidentally, Goliath also had four brothers. Presumably they were pretty good stature as well, because it mentioned that similar things about them in other places. For example, the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, is also said of Goliath's brother. And the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels, about 20, 25 pounds. You put that on the end of a stick and try to wiggle it around? Yeah. My brother Charlie's here this morning, and he was talking about being in the gym and picking up a 100-pound dumbbell on either arm and trying to walk with it. That's tough. Now, here's David, who's a young man. We don't know how old he was. I'm saying probably in his late teens, maybe early 20s, I don't know. But he's not fully developed. And he's obviously nowhere as big as Saul, because Saul was head and shoulders above everybody else. Verse 8, he, Goliath, stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, and he said to them, "Why do you come up out to draw up in battle array? Why are you dressed like you're going to war when you won't even come out and fight me?" You think about that? Why are you dressed in battle array? You ain't fighting. Bunch of cowards. "Am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul?" Now he's beginning to insult them. "Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me." Who would be the natural man to be chosen? Who did God say was supposed to go before his people and fight their battles? Well, originally God himself, but because they rejected him and they wanted the king, it should have been Saul. And Saul was equipped for it. He was physically blessed with that capacity. Regardless of how big Goliath was, he would be the biggest one there and the natural choice. And so he's pointing his finger at Saul. He's trying to draw Saul out of the crowd. He's trying to get him to come up and do his job. And I can only imagine what Saul is feeling like. What a coward, what a heel. This is my job, I know it. I ain't going to do it. So I'm going to start telling the people, you know, whoever will go out and fight him, I could do it myself, but you know, I don't want to get dirty. Whoever will go out and fight him, I'll make his family free of taxes, and I'll give him my daughter. Any takers? No, because every day for 40 days, Goliath would come out and issue his challenge, and everybody would run. Verse 9, "If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants." Notice how Goliath is making this about man to man. If my champion, if you know, I'm the champion, if I can beat your champion, man to man. That's what this battle is. It's all about men. They're losing sight of what God had instructed them. Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Then Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine. They were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now we've changed the scenes a little bit. Now David's the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse. He had 8 sons. Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. And the 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. The names of these 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, the second to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. Now, we've already been introduced to them, right? And it seems kind of funny that it's worded this way, because we just were introduced to them in the first chapter when Samuel went to go and pick out the king. And I would submit to you that one of the reasons it's there is this book was put together by a number of different stories. And it's a collection of stories together. So sometimes they might seem a little bit, why did you have to say that? You put it all together and it's all consistent, it stays together. Verse 14. David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend to his father's flock in Bethlehem. The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days, and he took his stand. Now you can imagine as he begins doing this, he comes out down toward the creek bed, and he's standing down there on their side, and he's shouting up to the Israelites on the other side. But as you watch it, you realize that each time he comes out, he's gradually encroaching. And to where now they're saying he's coming up. So he's crossing the creek bed, and he's getting closer to him each time. At some point, he's going to be right in their face. And every time he comes out, they back up. They're bunching up on the hill and bunching up on the hill and bunching up on the hill. It's not a good scene. Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days, and he took his stand. Then Jesse said to David his son, we're at verse 17, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain, these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to your brothers." It's 12, 15 miles. "Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000. You know, you want to win favor with the commander so that when he picks the guys that have to be first into battle, it's not going to be your sons. You're going to butter up the commander, cheese up the commander, I guess would be the way you put it. And look into the welfare of your brothers, bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David arose early in the morning, and he left the flock with a keeper, and he took the supplies as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp where the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry." That is almost, it's comedic in a way, but it's so sad. You see them there psyching each other up, kind of like guys in the locker room. "Yeah, yeah, yeah, we can't be beat, not in our house," and all this other stuff. Knowing full well when they get out there, it's like, oh no. After 40 days, who's kidding whom? Israel and the Philistines. There's also the aspect of you've been confronted with something and it terrified you and you ran, and then you're sitting around, maybe you've had a few drinks, as I'm sure that they did, and they're cheering each other up and toughening, okay, this time I'm really going to do it. And you get up there, maybe not. That's the picture as I see it. David leaves his baggage. He gets there to circle. He leaves his baggage with the care of the baggage keeper, the supply sergeant, if you will. And he runs to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. And as he's talking with them, behold, the champion of the Philistines from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines. Coming up, see, he's coming across the creek now. Now he's approaching them. Coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. And then what? All the men of Israel saw the man, and they fled from him and were greatly afraid. And I believe that included David initially. I don't think David came out there thinking he was supposed to be the leader of the army necessarily. He came out there to do his father's bidding, and he was going to find out how they were doing and whatnot. And he gets out there with them, and they're standing out there. Goliath comes out and does his thing, and everybody turns around and runs, and he just kind of follows with them. And it's almost like, what's going on? And what? I thought we were going to go to war. So he follows them back to the back, and they get back around their campfires, and they're all sitting around. And the men of Israel said, verse 25, "Have you seen the man who's coming up? Surely he's coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, will give him his daughter to make his father's house free in Israel. They don't pay taxes anymore. Kings, whoever kills Goliath, whoever offs him, going to get a big lump sum of cash, is not going to have to pay any taxes, and as a bonus, he's going to get the princess as a bride, which not only means you got a bride, but it also means that now you're family with the king. That's quite a deal. And David's listening to that, and his ears perk up. And he says, verse 26, David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done to the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" See, he's already thinking about, look how stupid you people look. You guys are God's own chosen people, and you're cowards. You are a reproach. You're an embarrassment. And what's the king going to do for the man that does this? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that should taunt the armies of the living God? Notice all along, you'd seen these men looking at another man. Army against army, man against man, champion against champion, and it was not working out well. David remembers that the real battle is God against whoever this is. So whoever that is has the problem, not him, right? That's a perspective that's very, very hard to keep in certain circumstances. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? Verse 27, "And the people answered him in accord with this word, saying, 'Thus it shall be done for the man who kills him.'" So they confirm that. That's what the king said. David's kind of working up his courage. This is great. Eliab, now remember, Eliab came out, he was the first one introduced because he's the oldest brother, big strapping handsome kid. And he comes out, and Samuel, when he sees him, says, "Yep, that's got to be the one God chose." "Nope, I've rejected him. Find me another." And so Samuel says to Jesse and to Eliab, to Jesse in front of all of his brothers, "No, you're not the one. God hasn't chosen you. He's rejected you." That had to sting. That had to kind of undermine his authority as the big brother. So he's probably smarting a little bit. And here comes David, who ultimately was anointed. So Eliab's probably got a chip on his shoulder where David is concerned. And he speaks to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David. And he said, "Why have you come down here? With whom have you left those sheep in the wilderness?" Sheep herders weren't thought of in great terms. And so he reminds all of the soldiers who were esteemed around there that this is a little sheep herder. He insults him in front of everybody that's there. He doesn't say, "This is my brother. You all need to get to know him." He said, "Now, this is a little sheep herder. Where'd you leave your sheep? Your little flock. I know the insolence and the wickedness of your heart." What did God say? "This is a man after my own heart." This is brother talking. Them's fighting words. Any of you ever fight with your brother? I never did. I just knew I'd whip him too bad. So here's his brother trying to pick a fight. And if I'm David, and I've already whipped a bear and a lion, I ain't afraid of my big brother. I'm not even afraid of Goliath. I'm gonna set this right. I'm going to not let him talk to me that way in front of the people around me. But you know what? David's a better man than I am. And he knows when to pick his fight and when to walk away. And he turns to his brother, and he says, "What have I done now? Wasn't I just asking a question?" And then he turns around and walks away from him, and he goes and asks that question to other people. Man, that is a man. We'll look in here in a little bit about when we go back to the introduction of him. And one of the things that was said about him was he's prudent in speech. That's David being prudent in speech. "I'm not going to pick a fight. I'm not going to escalate. This isn't important right now. This isn't about me. It isn't about you and me, Eliab. This is bigger than that." And he walks away. That's a big man. It's a good man. Verse 30, then he turned away from him to another, and he said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing as before. He's confirming the deal. Yep, that's the way it is. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine. Saul probably laughing. You can't go stand against this Philistine and fight with him. You're just a kid. He's been a warrior from the time he was twice your size. But David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took the lamb of the flock. Now that's another funny little linguistic thing. He's talking about two examples at the same time, and one time was a lion, another time it was a bear. And so in English it comes out a lion or a bear. It's not like David didn't know the difference of what was attacking his sheep, okay? It was a lion, or maybe it was a bear, I don't know. That doesn't sound like a very good story, does it? I was attacked by this big fuzzy thing. Sasquatch, maybe, I don't know. So a couple of different incidents here, and that becomes as evident as we read. David said, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, and I went out after him and attacked him. That is not what I would do. If I'm a shepherd and I'm watching sheep and a mountain lion comes in and grabs one and takes off, I'm going to go home and say, too bad. That lion came in and took a sheep. We just lost one. No. David takes off after him, runs him down, chokes him down, smashes him in the head and kills him. Verse 36, your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them since he has taunted the armies of the living God. Again, David has not lost perspective. David said, the Lord, Yahweh, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. David is not worried about his stature compared to Goliath, his abilities compared to Goliath. He's worried about Goliath's stature and abilities compared to God. And just as God delivered me, because I had no physical ability to beat the bear, just as God delivered me from the lion, because I shouldn't have been able to beat a lion, he'll deliver me from that. That's confidence, that's faith. That's experiential faith. I went out after him, and I attacked him, and I rescued it from his mouth. And then he rose up against me, and I seized him by his beard, and I struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be just like one of them since he's taunted the armies of the living God. Verse 37, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And then Saul, apparently convinced, says, go and may the Lord be with you. What a coward. Then Saul clothed David with his garments. Okay, this is interesting too, because we're thinking, okay, I'm going to protect David. I'm going to give him these garments. Never mind the fact that the garments are way too big for him and he's never used them. He's not comfortable with them at all. But think about that for a minute. If David did go out there dressed as Saul and the people all around there see Saul going out to meet Goliath, that's a coward. He's trying to disguise David and make it look like he did this thing. That's not cool. David puts on the stuff, and Sammy loves my boots. And if my boots are sitting there by the ottoman or something, he'll come put on the boots and try to lace them up and then try to walk around. And I kind of picture that as David trying to walk around in Saul's garb, trying to wield this sword. You know, this ain't going to work. I'm just going to stick with what I know works, my trusty little sling. I'm going to go with what I go. Because it's not the sword that matters. It's the God that matters. I could go out there with whatever, and if God's battle, God will win it. All I got to do is step out there in faith. So, let's go 39. David girded his sword over his armor, and he tried to walk. He had not tested them, so David said to Saul, I can't go with these. I've not tested them. And David took them off. Now, I'm sure that part of it was he wasn't comfortable with that stuff, but I think he also saw through with what Saul might be doing and did not want to afford him that opportunity. So he takes off Saul's armor. He takes a stick in his hand and he chooses for himself five smooth stones. You ever wonder why he chose five stones? Exactly. Some people thought, well, maybe I'll miss and I'll need, you know, that's me. I want the biggest magazine I can get. I'm 17 plus one. You forgot the one in the chamber. No, he picked five of them because Goliath has four brothers. I'm going to go out and kill Goliath, and if necessary, I'm going to kill all his brothers because it's only to be expected that if I kill Goliath, his brothers are probably going to rush me. So he's being ready. Takes a stick in his hand, chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook. He put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approaches the Philistine. Man, what a picture. The Philistine came on and approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. Now, my inclination would be to think, that's all it is, I'm just going to walk up there and confront him. But he's got to look at that and think, this has got to be a trick. I'm going to go up there and meet this kid, and I'm going to get assaulted from somewhere. So he does what a soldier should do, maintains his proper defenses, takes his shield bearer with him, and marches up there to meet David. And when he gets up there and really sees what's there, it says, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and handsome in appearance. Verse 43, Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine also said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. Goliath says to David, I'm going to feed you to the animals. Tough talk, scary. David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you what? In the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. You made a mistake there, buddy. You taunted the one God. That's who you're fighting. Verse 46, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down, remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies, not only of you, but of your entire army of the Philistines, to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth. I'm not just looking at you, Goliath. I'm taking you all. Gutsy. Why? The end of verse 46, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Look how Israel had defamed the honor of God by fleeing and running from God's enemies. And David puts an end to that. He's a leader. And all that assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by the sword or by the spear, for the battle is the Lord's. He will give you into our hands. Verse 48, then it happened when the Philistine rose and came up and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. David put his hand into his bag. He took from it a stone, one stone. He slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead. The stone sank into the forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Imagine being the sword bearer, the shield bearer before that. What just happened? Now I'm out here all by myself. This is not good. Verse 50. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. And he struck the Philistine and he killed him. There was no sword in David's hand. Remember, David said, I'm going to cut your head off. David ran. He stood over the Philistine. He took his sword and he drew it out of his sheath and he killed him and he cut his head off with it. Why do you suppose he did that? If you're standing back 300 yards and you see this little conflict and this kid does this and Goliath falls down, you're going, what happened? Did he trip? What happened? David goes up there, he takes Goliath's own sword, hacks off Goliath's head, and holds it up so that everybody can see the head detached from the body, and there is no doubt to anybody there watching what just happened. Goliath, your champion, is dead. You didn't have to be close enough. You didn't have to have a doctor come in and see if there's a pulse and respiration. If Goliath has just passed out, none of that. There's no question. He is dead. 51, David ran, stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut his head off with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled, including the four brothers of Goliath. So the other stones didn't need to be used, right? And the men of Israel and Judah arose, and they shouted, and they pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way to Sarim, even to Gath and Ekron. And the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. David took the Philistine's head and he brought it to Jerusalem, but he kept the weapons in his tent. Those were his spoils, his little souvenirs, if you will. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner and the commander of the army, "Whose son is this young man? Tell me again who this kid is." Part of that probably because I got to decide whether or not I'm keep good with my word. Whose family is it that I'm setting free from taxes? Who might be, what family might be coming into my family? You know, he's kind of clarifying all this, starting to judge it up, because he never probably believed that that would come to pass. Abner says, "By your life, O king, I don't know. I don't even remember." He may have known. They probably all knew a little bit about where David was from, whatnot, but he wasn't going to tell the king. The king said, "You inquire whose son the youth is." So when David returned from the killing of the Philistine, Abner took him and he brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" David answered, "I'm the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." David didn't say, "I'm the king that's going to replace you." He remained humble. We talked when we started this conversation about what does it mean to be a man after God's own heart. What are some of the character qualities that David had? And I was thinking about this morning, and you probably, not just this morning, but in thinking about this, and you probably will come up with some others that I don't have included here, and if you do, feel free to bring them out. But one of the things that first struck me about David is his devotion to duty. Remember when he was the shepherd boy out there and the lion and the bear come and snatch a sheep out of there? You know, there's no way I'm going to go try to chase one down. Maybe if I got a couple of trusty rifles with me, I might take a long shot at him. But I'm not going to try to chase him down and wrestle him to the ground and bash his head in. That's devotion to duty. I'm the shepherd. That sheep is my responsibility. I'm going to risk my life and everything I have to go save that sheep. Wow. The only other person I've seen with that kind of devotion to his duty was Jesus Christ himself. Also, you look at David and you see his zeal, his wholeheartedness. In a little bit, we're going to, not today, but we're going to see the story of where David comes to claim the money, the bride, the tax-free status, and the king says, "Yeah, I don't know, I'm going to change the deal." Because he really didn't want David to survive. So he says, "I want you to go out and I want you to collect 100 Philistine foreskins." That's pretty disgusting. But imagine what it would be like to go out and say, "You've got to go out and kill 100 Philistines." After you've managed maybe to kill 4 or 5, the word is out. They know what you're about. You're one guy against the whole army. So he knew that there was no chance that David could make it. What did David do? If 100 is good, 200 is better. Can you imagine how Saul would feel when David comes back in and goes, "There's your 100 and 100 to boot. Now give me what I got coming." And he's still alive. And Saul's going to be, what's ever going to kill this guy? How am I going to get rid of him? What sort of thing have I been plagued with here? His zeal, his wholeheartedness, his discipline, his prudence in speech. You remember when Eliab came out and defamed him in front of everybody. And he knew this was not the time, this was not the place, this wasn't the battle. Several times as we see him dealing with Saul, very, very courteous, very humble, a man beyond what I could ever hope to be, I believe. He was disciplined. Part of that discipline we mentioned last week in that he was renowned as a musician. It's one thing to have musical talent and be able to make noise. It's another to take that talent and work it and perfect it until you really are skilled at doing something. And that's not only true with musicianship, but it's true with anything. And we mentioned that last week. The true quality of someone is to take the natural gifts, the charisma that God has given him, and not just to wow the people around, but to actually create that into a craft, to apply the discipline, the work, to become something that is wonderful, that is great. When they built the temple, and God says, I want you to go out and find all these artisans, skilled craftsmen and whatnot, because that is a way of giving back to God. It's a way of honoring God. Not only did you give me this gift, but here's what I developed out of it. Same thing with the gifts of the talents. It's all the same principle there. And David was that kind of a man. He was spirit-filled. He was led by the Spirit. He kept the perspective and the focus on God. He didn't let the circumstances get in the way and dissuade him from what was really happening. This whole time, this battle was between God and the Philistine armies, the enemies of his people. And the children of Israel got it in their head that somehow it was their battle, that they were going to have to win it on their own. How often does that happen to us? We're challenged by something, as Orlean brought up, and we think, how can I ever match up to this challenge? How can I ever struggle against this? How can I ever survive? How can I? Like Peter stepping out of the boat onto the waves. How can I do this? You can't. You don't have to. It's already done. Wow, that's a comfort. Everybody in the Israeli army, I believe, looked up and they saw Goliath and they said, who am I that I should go against Goliath? Their sights were on themselves. David looked out and he said, who is Goliath to go up against God? That's the perspective we need.